Hello and welcome to Olden Village. Today is Friday, June 23rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled Keeler's Exiles, presented by David Crow. Number is CRD 2006-05. Let's listen in.
Crow, and I am the chair of the English department at Augustana College, and all this week we have been, for those of you who have not been attending, all this week we've been listening to short stories that raise interesting questions about faith and spirituality. And we open and close the week with Garrison Keillor in a sort of shameless display on my part of appealing to Midwestern Lutheran sensibilities and to the longing we all have, I suppose, for our home. I was raised in Minnesota, and I'm told that when I get on the phone, I sound like a Minnesotan. Maybe I sound like a Minnesotan to you all the time, I don't know. But when I'm on the phone, I say, well, how you been then? What have you been up to then? Things like that. I don't know if we want to push this story too hard in the intellectual direction, but there is actually a lot going on in the story. The title alone leads us to a thematic interest, and that is exiles. The exiles that Keillor is writing about today are the young people raised in Lake Wobegon who then get themselves educated and move to the cities. And you know that in the Lake Wobegon stories, the interplay between those two is very, very important. The longing we have for home and comfort and religious orthodoxy and all those things connected with Lake Wobegon, and then the real life we have in the city where things are faster paced and where we have professional responsibilities and where there's a lot of relativism about things spiritual and things religious. It's the interplay between those that I think Keillor is playing off of. You can try to detect which you think is his preference in this story. I wouldn't say, for example, that it's necessarily Lake Wobegon. I don't think that Keillor poses Lake Wobegon as by any means a perfect place or a utopian place. If there were, it's above average. However,
oh,
yes,
it's above average.
Well, if you're raised in a small city or a small town, that's what you're reading. A lot of things there. Raised in the country on a farm or something. There's a lot of things there which really...
It rings very true. It rings very true, Rifa. Yeah. Except that I think the bachelors in my town probably wash their sheets more than once a year. That strikes me as untrue.
You have to go farther northwest to find the true Norwegian bachelor farm.
Do you have to?
Yeah, when they say Telwich, they really mean it, too.
Yeah, Right around Gopher Prairie, Staggerford, and Lake Wobegon there in that
just
area.
Just like West Creek.
Pardon me?
Just think West Breed.
I never knew much about the guy, so
he was probably a bachelor farmer.
Yeah. Oh, was he? Oh.
Right.
North Dakota.
Yeah.
All right. Looks like the ice cream crowd is coming in. It's a good thing I haven't started the story. The other theme going on that you might want to listen for is the theme of two roads. There's going to be an English teacher in this story who is bringing home essays to grade, and they're all on that doggone Frost poem. A road diverged in a yellow wood, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which almost everyone misreads, by the way. If we get to it, maybe I can give you the correct reading of that poem, which is not that we choose the correct road. It's something entirely different from that, but we may get to that. But in any case, there's more than one reference to two roads going on, people making, which I, of course, interpret to mean choices. This will be a story about people making crucial choices, fundamental meaning choices in their lives, so watch for that as well. And then also, some of the details in this story, which look just like sort of the detritus of semi-rural homes in northern Minnesota, are in fact pretty carefully calculated Christian imagery, and I urge you to watch carefully for that too. That I almost regret telling you about because it makes me look smart if I catch that and you don't. But I'm hinting that you can catch that. So any questions or comments before I begin on the Garrison Keillor story?
This is the Christmas Exiles?
It's just titled Exiles, but it's about coming home for Christmas. Yep. You heard a little taste of it last night in the so-called meditation. Now you're going to find out how it turns out. It has been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. Warm and foggy on Tuesday, And late in the day, as the temperature fell, fog froze on the trees and made white bare trees in which the fog appeared ghostly beautiful, as if you could walk into these trees and receive immortal powers of a sort we all want at Christmas, the power to gather our friends and loved ones close around us and prevent suffering and evil and death from touching them. When I was little, I worried about a group of men I called the capital M murderers, who had killed before and would kill again because killing meant nothing to them. They had nothing to lose. It was the electric chair for them either way. They were now driving in a stolen black sedan toward a Y in the road where two roads diverged. And if they chose one, they'd come to our house and kill us. And if they didn't, they wouldn't. I could keep my family safe by prayer. At night, I crawled into bed between cold sheets, like sheets of ice, and prayed to God to keep the murderers away from us. And as an extra precaution, in addition to prayer, I always got into bed from the left side. I lay on my right side. I prayed the exact same prayer. And although I knew I shouldn't, in the dark, I made the sign of the cross on the odd chance that God was not a Protestant. I pulled the blankets up and lay warming my little hollow, listening to the house creak, smelling the Vicks my mother put on me as a precaution, and felt I had kept the murderers from our door. Then one night I got into bed from the wrong side, exposing my family to evil because I was in a hurry. So I got out and got back in on the correct side, but was still afraid. So I took my radio into bed with me. It was the size of a bread box. I pulled the covers over my head and tuned in Bob Franklin, host of Music by Moonlight, the old smoothie he was called, because he made you feel like you and him were close. Hello, friends, Bob Franklin here. Say, I believe that I know you well enough to say that you're discriminating when it comes to the finer things, and particular about the details being just right, just the way you want them, and that's why I know that Jurisex Dry Cleaning in Albany is just the place for you. It thrilled me as a boy to hear a man take me into his confidence that way, but instead of old Bob playing Glenn Miller, there was a preacher on the air who wasn't friendly at all and didn't think I was discriminating and didn't think dry cleaning would do me much good one way or the other. He seemed to suggest that the murderers were standing over my bed about to stab me with an ice pick, and that that was exactly what I deserved. What was Brother Carl and his Wall of Hope revival show doing in the place of old Bob and Music by Moonlight? Then I checked my clock. It was 5:30 in the morning. We were safe for another day. Corinne Inquist came home for Christmas on Sunday. She came barreling north in her red VW from Minneapolis, arguing with a preacher on the radio, telling him his theology was repressive, when she noticed she was going 75 miles per hour. She cruised through the lights of town and turned down the long familiar driveway to their house by the lake. In the back seat were two tins of tea for gifts and 132 critical essays by her 17-year-old students on Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. These essays she was planning to grade on Monday. Her parents' house seemed like a quiet retreat with only her and Hjalmar and Virginia for Christmas. She pulled up the driveway and parked by the old limestone wall. She got out the shopping bag of presents and essays and walked up three steps to the back door and put her bare hand on the cold brass knob, and a sudden cold thought came to mind. This soon shall pass, and it won't be too long. She swayed slightly and then went in. Hello, said Hjalmar, and kissed her. Hello, dear, you look so wonderful, said Virginia. The tree in the same place beside the old piano in front of the bright fish tank, orange and silver guppies seemed to swim among the ornaments, drifting to and fro like orange and silver snowflakes that never reach the ground, fish in the branches among the lights. Dozens of exiles returned for Christmas. At Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility, Father Emil roused himself from bed, where he's been down with cancer since Columbus Day, and said Christmas Eve Mass. He was inspired by the sight of all the lapsed Catholics parading into church with their unbaptized children, and he gave them a hard homily, strolling right down into the congregation. Shame. Shame on us for leaving what we were given that was good and true, he said. To receive a great treasure in our younger days, and to abandon it so that we can lie down in the mud with swine. He stood one hand on the back of a pew, and everyone in that pew, children of this church who grew up and moved away and did well, and now tell humorous stories at parties about Father Emil and what it was like to grow up Catholic, all of them shuddered a little, afraid he might grab them by their Harris tweed collars and stand them up and ask them questions. What a shame, what a shame. They came for Christmas to hear music and see the candles and smell incense and feel hopeful. And here was their old priest with hair in his ears whacking them around. Was it a brain cancer he had? Shame, shame on us. He looked around at all the little children he'd given First Communion to, now grown heavy and prosperous and sad and indolent, but clever enough to explain their indolence and sadness as a rebellion against orthodoxy, a protest, adventurous, intellectual, which really was only dullness of spirit. He stopped. It was so quiet you could hear them not breathing. Then he said that this was why our Lord had come, to rescue us from dullness of spirit, and so the shepherds had found, and so shall we, and then it was Christmas again. Dozens of exiles were back, including some whom their families weren't expecting, because they'd said they weren't coming, couldn't come. We're sorry, but it was just out of the question. But Christmas exerts powerful forces. We turn a corner in a wretched shopping mall, and some few bars of a tune turn a switch in our heads, and gates open, and tons of water thunder through Hoover Dam, the big turbines spin, electricity flows, and we get in our car and go back like salmon. Larry the Sad Boy was there, who was saved 12 times in the Lutheran Church, an all-time record. Between 1953 and 1961, he threw himself weeping and contrite on God's throne of grace on 12 separate occasions, and this in a Lutheran church that wasn't evangelical, had no altar call, no organist playing Just As I Am without one plea, while a choir hummed and a guy with shiny hair took hold of your heartstrings and played you like a cheap guitar. This is the Lutheran church, not a bunch of hillbillies. These are Scandinavians, and they repent in the same way that they sin, discreetly, tastefully, at the proper time, and bring a jello salad for afterward. Larry Sorensen came forward weeping buckets and crumpled up at the communion rail to the amazement of the minister who had delivered a dry sermon about stewardship and who now had to put his arm around this limp, soggy individual and pray with him and see if he had a ride home. 12 times. Even we fundamentalists got tired of him. Granted, we're born in original sin and are worthless and vile, but 12 conversions is too many. God didn't mean us to feel guilt all our lives. There comes a point when you should dry your tears and join the building committee and start grappling with the problem of the church furnace and the church roof and make church coffee and be of use. But Larry kept on repenting and repenting. He came up for Christmas and got drunk and knocked over the Christmas tree. That was before 2 p.m. He spent the next 8 hours apologizing for it, and the penance was worse than the crime. Eddie the jealous boy came home. He told his parents he wasn't going to come, but they didn't protest enough, and he felt unwanted, and so he came up with his lovely wife, Eunice. She is the most beautiful woman ever to leave Lake Wobegon, having been elected Tri-County Queen in 1960, Miss 6th Congressional District same year, first runner-up in the 1962 Miss Midwest contest, and then Miss Upper Mississippi Basin by the U.S. Corps of Engineers. And having won them all, she retired from royalty because it made Eddie crazy to see other men look at her and like her. If she so much as touched a man on the arm in a friendly way, it meant she'd later spend hours listening to Eddie's hot, dry, angry voice and endure days of his silence. And so this funny and lovely woman has tried to please him and make herself quiet and dull and unattractive, but he's more jealous than ever. On Christmas afternoon, when he looked up from a robot he was assembling and noticed that Eunice and her brother-in-law Fred were nowhere to be seen, he tore around in a frenzy, ran outdoors, got in the car, there is no motel in town, and headed for the skating rink. The warming house was open. Maybe they were kissing in there. Maybe they were skating together. Maybe they were off in the woods naked in the snow. He saw her alone walking. He jumped out, ran up and said, "Where is he? Where's Fred?" She stared back at him with a dull look in her eyes. "Fred didn't come home for Christmas this year," she said. "Don't you remember? He and Marcy went to Des Moines." Corinne put off grading those papers until Monday and got busy baking cookies and some little currant buns from an old Norwegian recipe. She hadn't had them since she was little, and now she was baking them herself. Amazing, a delicious smell from childhood that brings back every sweet old aunt and grandma as if they're there beside you, and you do it with just a little saffron. Monday night, she made herself start those papers, and then carolers came, and it wasn't until Tuesday afternoon that she really faced up to it. 132 essays of 500 words each, about 70,000 words about the poem Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. And I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And of those words, at least 10,000 were I, me, or mine. And this poem makes me think of what happened to me when I was 10 and my parents said to me, for them, all roads converged into the first person singular. It was hard reading, very hard, and their teacher finally chose the road that led away from the stack of essays toward the Christmas tree and the fish tank. A lovely thing about Christmas is that it's compulsory, like a thunderstorm, and we all go through it together. It's not individual, it's sociable. Foxy the Proud Boy came home, but now he is Richard to everyone except his close pals in the grain futures business in Minneapolis, where he is Pinky. He drove up in a pink 1987 Ferlinghetti, a car so fabulous that when he sits in it, even en route to his origins in a little house painted lavatory green, he feels attractive and special. He forgets his dull, seedy relatives who come out and look at his fantastic car, its red leather seats, the incredible instrument panel that shows you the tides, the movement of planets and galaxies. They peer in the tinted windows and say, "Jeez, there's no room in there, Richard. Two seats. What are you thinking of? What do you do when you got things to haul?" They don't see that Richard is traveling light. He's secure in himself. And with Vanessa sitting next to him, that's a total reality. And his life is complete. And yet, why does he turn pale when he leads this fabulous woman in a silver lamé shirt into the dim little house? Why does he tremble? Is it the pictures on the walls, the praying hands, the threshers by Millet, a Winslow Homer ship, needlepoint, we get too soon old and too late smart? Is it his family, who never learned the art of making conversation because they only talk to people they know? A slow and terrible death, asphyxiation in your own past. All afternoon he's dying to get back in the Ferlinghetti and go home. At the first decent opportunity, he begins the long ritual goodbye. "Well, I guess it's time we..." "No, really, Ma." Vanessa has to lie. "Well, okay, just one, but then we've got to..." "Lie." "No, I'd like to, but we promised those friends we'd lie. Finally, with a wave and a roar, they pull away, and she turns to Richard the Proud and says, "They were nice, I liked them." But his eyes are full of tears from exhaustion and relief and guilt and from pride. He really does love this car. It gives him so much pleasure. Corinne didn't see Richard, Larry, or Eddie. She stayed home. On Christmas Eve, she and Hjalmar and Virginia sat and talked and listened to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, both sides, A and B, and their old scratchy record of Lionel Barrymore in A Christmas Carol. They watched Midnight Mass from St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York and ate the saffron buns. In the morning, Hjalmar took their dog Puddles for a walk. A mile away, the old dog was exhausted. Hjalmar had to pick him up and carry him home. Hjalmar was too tired to drive into St. Cloud to the Powers Hotel for the elegant Christmas buffet, and so, because there were only three of them, Corinne said, "Let's not fuss. Let's make a little turkey dinner with the microwave Daddy got you for Christmas last year." "Fine," Virginia said. "It's under the bed in the guest room in the box." They both studied the operating manual. In its attempt to describe the incredible flexibility of the microwave, its various functions and options and alternatives, the infinite variety and joy of the thing, it bewildered them. The control panel had buttons numbered from 0 to 9 and other buttons that said over, stop, clear, from, time, recall, auto, memory. Which brought back the memory of how lovely it was to put water in a pot, boil it, and drop stuff in. "No," Corinne cried. "We can't let electronics defeat us." They put the frozen turkey dinner pouches in the microwave, pushed a combination of buttons that made the light go on and the fan whir, and left the kitchen and went and conversed until the bell rang. But something was wrong. The peas were a bluish green. The pouch of turkey had flecks of silvery ash in it. They had each had two glasses of sherry, and were in a philosophical mood. Corinne looked at her mother looked at Corinne. "Well," said Corinne, "I'll never have babies." "So," said Virginia, "I'll never be a grandma." "That's life," they said. "Let's go to David and Judy's and see what Christmas charity really is worth nowadays. They invited us, didn't they? It was a month ago, and we said no, but we didn't know then what we know now, so let's go." The Reverend David Inquist and his wife Judith were in the midst of an argument when they heard the knock on the door. They were arguing whether she is always wrong or not. She was saying that yes, she can never do anything right and never pleases him, and he was saying that no, she was wrong now, but she is usually right, and no, she often pleases him, and yes, he does tell her. When he opened the door, expecting to find someone with a gift in hand, and saw his aunt and uncle and cousin. "Hello," said Hjalmar. "We thought we'd come down." "How are you?" said Virginia. "Merry Christmas." "What are you having for dinner?" asked Corinne. "Aren't you going to invite us in?" That's it. So, usually about this time, I ask for comments from the crowd, and I can do that. I can point to some things going on in the story, too, that I think are kind of interesting. What did you notice about the story? Any particularly memorable lines, issues that were interesting to you?
My wife and I have the same argument, so.
Yeah. Every man and his wife have that argument, I think, probably. It works. Every man who has a wife, yeah. Right.
Well, he's like Thurber. He has a talent for picking out those little things that
yeah.
couples or family members do to get each other.
He was actually trained on the New Yorker writers like Thurber and Perlman and those other humorists, E.B. White, for example. He really picked up a lot of their gentle style, I think, and that sense of detail.
The part of bringing someone home and sort of being embarrassed by the inside of your house or what's hanging on the wall, how seedy things look.
Right, exactly.
Those holy relics you weren't supposed to look for, the threshers and the praying hands.
Yeah. There's two of them, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the car.
Uh-huh.
No, is there such a car as a Ferlinghetti? I mean, because he takes that car out, like, you know, to the planets and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
I mean, that's one spot in the story where he gets surreal.
Yeah.
And you know, that he should name a car after Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Yeah. Instead of Maserati, right?
Yeah, or Ferrari.
Yeah, or Ferrari.
Or Lamborghini.
Okay, so we Foxy. Got. He's Foxy the Proud Boy is the one who. There are three characters who are brought into the story, and he's one of them. And you know what does Foxy seem to convey in the context of this story?
Materialism.
Yeah, materialism, consumerism. Yeah. Even, you know, at the end of the day, the tears in his eyes are tears of relief at getting back into his car, which gives him pleasure. The family doesn't give him pleasure, the holiday doesn't give him pleasure, but his car does. So it's very much about materialism, consumerism. I don't mean to dismiss him necessarily, but that does seem to be going on.
Even the supportive words of his girlfriend don't mean a thing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, she seems more human than he, right? She says, "Hey, they were nice. I liked them," but he can't seem to bear it.
Well, his family didn't exactly appreciate his vehicle, even though it was.
No, they're utterly practical people, right? So, yeah. It's interesting. My sister-in-law brought home one of those little. What are those little cars? The little British cars, a Mini, yeah. And it was exactly what people said. "Honey, there's only two seats in there." Yeah, when you got lumber to bring home, what are you going to do? We got Foxy the Proud Boy, Larry the Sad Boy, is that the name of the... There's Eddie the Jealous Boy, and I think it's Larry the Sad Boy. Yeah. What are the details you remember connected to these people?
Well, the guy, the jealous guy.
Yeah.
Who was he?
Eddie.
He was scary to me.
Yeah, he is scary, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a kind of...
obsessive.
Yeah, obsessive, right, possessiveness.
And when she says, you know, Fred didn't even come home for Christmas, that's very scary.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on?
Right. He has positively abused his wife through the course of their marriage, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Tolerates it.
And she tolerates it, right. In fact, she conforms to it. Yeah, that it strikes me as about the saddest moment in this particular Lake Wobegon tale. And, you know, we think of these as really lighthearted and carefree in some ways, very reassuring, but that's really a horrible little glimpse of a marriage, I think, in there.
I see more of his monologues that way, that there's a part of them that are warm, but there's a part that's pretty hard, too.
I think so, too. I think that's actually what makes us care about listening to them.
Yeah.
They're not just sort of smarmy memories, but they, in fact, engage the dilemmas that we live with.
I think he has
real
a lot
life,
of anger about having grown up in a small town.
Yeah.
I was going to say that, too. He's got a lot of anger.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's about, but...
Well, he seems to connect small towns with conformism and with limited horizons. And he seems to have wanted to get past those pretty badly. He also connects home, though, with love and affection.
And he's also made all his money off of the material from those small towns.
He certainly has. He found himself a gold mine, didn't he?
Yeah.
I read somewhere, well, one of my professors at Luther, actually, Peter Scholl, who's a friend of mine, has the Twain biography of Keeler, which I've read. And he gets into some detail on how Keeler actually writes these tales. And he does it in the course of about 3 or 4 days in a given week. I mean, he'll write the Lake Wobegon story for that Saturday's taping during the week ahead, which would be more pressure than I'd want on me.
Well, it's the sermon. It's the sermon.
Yeah, it's the sermon.
Mm-hmm. One a week.
If it's a mass, that's the sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Larry the Sad Boy, then, let's connect him with the sort of major theme going on there.
He never hears the good news.
Yeah, he keeps converting, doesn't it?
He's also an alcoholic, isn't he?
Pardon?
Isn't he alcoholic, too?
Right, he's alcoholic as well.
Right.
Or at least he manages alcohol poorly on this particular incident.
Yeah,
we don't know, yeah, but we've got alcohol problems anyway.
When you have to
be sad. The antidote seems so sad. You know, take care of the church roof and...
Yeah, I'm interested to hear you say that. Does that feel sad to you that's what the church becomes, that quotidian business of repairing the roof, keeping the furnace going, and making coffee?
For some people, that's all ministry is.
Yeah? Well, tell me more about how you feel about that.
That's pathetic.
It's pathetic. Yeah.
Well, somebody's got to do it, though, too.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it at all.
You gotta have a roof on a church, you know.
The problem I see, though, is many of our places of worship become the shrines that we worship the shrine rather than.
Yeah, as long as that isn't the mission of the church. I mean, it's important to have people like that in the congregation, but that can't be what the congregation is about.
Right. Well, isn't it interesting how we have two sort of extreme choices here? On the one hand, that sort of frantic self-evaluation that leads you to conversion after conversion after conversion. You know, just start playing without one plea and we head for the altar, you know. Versus that simply taking care of the daily business of the plant. In between there must be something that we want, isn't there? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, don't you think all three of those exemplify that? He's kind of saying we have these two extremes in all three stories, and the people in them have no understanding of each other, and therein lies the silence.
Right. In each of these instances, speaking in literary terms, we probably have something either like satire, or at the very least, we've got irony. We got to decide, I guess, whether it's satire. And in either case, the reader's task is going to be to to find through the absence of the desirable thing in the story, that thing itself, the desirable thing. So what would we claim here that, that Keeler is actually after? What is he urging us to embrace or to foster in our lives?
Balance.
Yeah, balance of one kind or another. You know, enjoy the things in our lives, but not make them the idols of our worship. Treat others with some love and respect instead of controlling abuse. This is the tough one.
Get a life.
Yeah. No, but I think we don't need to be converting. We can live in some confidence of our of the grace that abounds in our life. It seems to me we don't need to be converting constantly. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, life in our baptism, daily repentance, right, turning to God, a passion for Christ, whatever. But you don't have to.
Yeah.
It also seems like both those options of constantly sobbing and converting, self-seeking, as is the only taking care of
exactly.
The church.
Exactly. You can call it a spiritual life if you want, but really Larry the Sad Boy is desperately seeking attention, isn't he, over and over again? I read him that way too, is very self-obsessed. Absolutely. I don't know, I guess it raises the question of whether then, since we've covered these characters, of whether Corinne and Hjalmar and Virginia, it's hard to know how Norwegian to go with a name like Hjalmar.
You go to the extreme.
Hjalmar. Right. Come with me, Hjalmar. Or whether it, like one of my best high school buddies had that name and his dad just went by Helmer. So it gets anglicized. Do these represent the balance that the other characters, that the more sort of satirical characters don't have? Mandy?
Definitely, especially when the way she's grading her papers is she's trying to get her students to turn away from themselves and not focus on themselves so much.
Yeah, that's right.
And when you're talking about the Christian imagery, it's kind of the little nuclear family goes off to find a place to rest.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
Mandy's an English major at Augustana College. You can tell she's been pretty well trained. No, you're right. You're right. That final scene, in other words, right? Mm-hmm. It's the archetypical Christmas scene, isn't it? It's parents and a child looking for room at the inn, looking for a place to be. And the question there is whether the Reverend Inquist and his warring wife Judith, is it Judith?
Yeah.
Whether they're going to have the graciousness to invite their relatives in for the meal and celebrate Christmas with them.
And they've just gone through a nice, healthy argument.
Exactly. The kind that you have to shut down immediately when someone comes to the door, right? Yeah, exactly. Please.
Was it his intention or not, but this certainly gives you a negative feeling about small towns because these three people haven't been nurtured by this town to go forth into the world with a sense of personhood.
Right, right.
Was that what we're supposed to say?
I don't know. I don't know if
it's one narrow story out of a whole bunch, so maybe you can't read that.
Right. It's a little vignette. But on the other hand, you know, Keeler tries to, I think, craft these things so that they convey some sensible attitude about, you know, about the small town. I wonder, for example, about Father Emil's sermon. What does that convey about what it's like to live in this town? Is that a supportive and reasonable homily, or was it a big problem?
Guilt.
A lot of guilt involved in it, I guess. Perpetual responsibility.
I'm wondering if he's feeling whether his ministry was worth it. I mean, everybody leaves.
Yeah. And of course, he's facing Henry James called the distinguished thing. He's got cancer, and he knows that he's probably on his way out. And so he seems to be feeling some of that tension. He brings it to the pulpit. You know, he does make the turn, though, doesn't he? Before he's done, he says, "But our Lord came to redeem all this," and then it was Christmas again.
But I think he speaks a point of view, and one of the points of view that Keeler wants to put out there. I mean, it's hilarious. But I think, you know, we were talking about how we think Keeler's angry. I mean, that's his anger, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, he has characters that go off.
Yeah, they do. They do. He enjoys that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets a lot of comedy out of it, actually. Yeah.
Well, and he grew up in a very strict Brethren church.
He did. He indicates it even in this story. He says even we fundamentalists got tired of it.
There probably wasn't a lot of grace there.
Yeah, the Plymouth Brethren, I guess, of Anoka, Minnesota, we're talking about here. There is one other bit of Christian imagery that I think is kind of neat in this story. And believe it or not, it's that fish tank. Did you catch that?
Over by the tree and the fish tank?
The tree and the fish tank. Let me read the passage to you, and I think you'll see what's going on. My book is falling apart. It's just as Corinne arrives home and greets her parents. She, in a sense, misquotes a Bible verse. She says, this soon shall pass, and it won't be too long. In other words, she knows her parents are going to go before too long, and she's going to lose all of that comfort that comes with going home. I think the biblical passage about this too shall pass is about actually troubles going away, isn't it? But anyway. She swayed slightly and then went in. Hello, said Hjalmar and kissed her. Hello, dear. You look so wonderful, said Virginia. By the way, the name Virginia reinforces Mandy's point, because if she would then be taking the role of the Virgin Mary, Virginia. The tree in the same place beside the old piano in front of the bright fish tank. Here we go. Orange and silver guppies seemed to swim among the ornaments, drifting to and fro like orange and silver snowflakes that never reach the ground. Fish in the branches among the lights. You guys have been around churches long enough to know this one, right? Ixtus? Okay. The fish is the symbol of Christ or of the Eucharist in the Christian tradition. So this imagery seems to say something like, we don't want just an ornamental Christmas. We don't want just dead ornaments hanging on our Christmas tree. We want a Christmas tree that's alive with Christ, or in which Christ is alive in Christmas. Am I pressing too hard? No, I'm not. You might think so, but I'm not. It's there. I think that's an extremely clever image on Keeler's part to weave that into the story in a way that we wouldn't necessarily catch. It appears later as well. Corinne says, oh, where is it? She's about to grade papers again, and she turns away from them and goes to the fish tank again, the Christmas tree in the fish tank. Well, anyway, I'm not catching it. I'm not catching it. But yes?
I'd be just curious if everybody here grew up in a small town in the Midwest, or if they've grown up in a big city, if they feel differently. I grew up in a small town, mm-hmm. Minnesota, you know, in... I can see things in there that was, but if you were in the city, do you see that same thing?
That's a great question. I wonder if people who grow up in a city feel the same way about Keeler that some of the rest of us do. That's a great question.
Is everybody from a small town?
Yeah. Who grew up in a small town? Okay. And city dwellers? Really? Well, city dwellers, you got to tell us how you react to Garrison Keeler and his. His longing for his hometown.
People are the same wherever.
I guess
honestly,
so.
Yeah.
I guess so.
And families are dysfunctional everywhere.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Yeah.
Although there is a quaintness to his imagery that you don't tend to encounter as much in city life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his the way he paints the town and the interrelationships of people. I think I think I have the benefit of having grown up in a large city, but now living in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see the difference in the way you relate to your neighbors and that you even know them. We didn't know all of our neighbors when we lived in a big town.
Yeah, I guess that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. And I think you just, the imagery is different.
But I think I grew up in Indiana, in Indianapolis, and then moved out to Seattle. And the parts of it that I can relate to from my personal experience are from being in Indiana. So part of it, I think, is what part of the country it is and the attitudes that come.
I've always wondered about people from outstate, if you're not a Minnesotan, how you react to all the stuff about the ethnic stuff, the Norwegian stuff, and the Lutheran stuff, and all of that, if that sort of...
Well, that seems like satire until you move to a small town.
Yeah.
You find out
that's right.
Irony.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Heartland, Minnesota, population 332.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
You and then you.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
I think mine also have to do with how old you are, because I lived in Eagle Rock, which was in Southern California between Glendale and Pasadena, and most people would think of that as living in a big city, but it was really a small town. I mean, we knew everyone, but part of that, I think, is my age, because what I see now is that our communities and TVs, cars, air conditioners, whatever you want to blame for it, have created situations where we're very isolated.
Right.
And
right.
I think that certainly is still not as prevalent in small towns, but certainly it's taken away a lot from big cities.
Yeah. Yesterday's story was a Raymond Carver tale in which there's this generalized prospering couple in a very generalized city, and their child is struck by a car and goes into a coma. There is no neighbor who even comes to be with them in the hospital. They are completely on their own. And that, I think sketches what Keeler works against. I think he taps into that part of us that really does want community, that wants neighbors who talk to each other, that wants care going on, that wants wants family relations to be tight. You were going to say something, ma'am.
Well, yeah, I live in Pasadena, California, which is interesting. You mentioned between Glendale and Pasadena. But Garrison Keillor fills the Hollywood Bowl every year.
Yes.
And I don't think there are that many Norwegian Lutherans.
No, not enough to fill the bowl. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, so there's a universal thing that he's tapping into, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think there's something about Christian community that rings true whether you're in a city or a town.
Yeah.
From the so-called hillbilly tradition in this story, Baptist church, in a big city, but like all the church politics, all the like dynamics of relationship are similar.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And even,
Go ahead,
some of the community, because, you know, I live in Seattle, and my church has a particular drawing, so it's a citywide draw, and, you know, we bring food to people when they have a baby. We take care of people when they're sick. We, you know, fix people's houses when they're old. And if I stop going to church for a while, you know, I'll start getting phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
So it creates that, even in a big city.
Yeah.
I served my first parish in northwest Minnesota in a fairly dispersed congregation of Norwegian farmers, just like Hobogon. And I remember, especially Christmas time, visiting Norwegian bachelor farmers, a pair of brothers. When I first got there, their traditions were extremely important around Christmas, even though these guys would live simply. And I mean, it was at the end of my ministry, the two last visits I made with these guys, way out in the country, one of them was very sick and was about to die. And he had a concern for his brother, that was the only living member of his family that would be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern was, who was going to be there when he died?
Mm-hmm.
They had 8 cats in their home.
Mm-hmm.
And his concern was, will anybody be there when my brother dies, or will the cats eat him?
Mm-hmm.
Grief. That was, some of the imagery Garrison Keillor brings in about Norwegian bachelor farmers is just true.
Well, and you know, what I heard in one of the things that really interested me in what you just said is the compassion that with which you delivered that. And I feel that in Keillor. You've been spoken of his anger a couple times.
Yeah.
But I also feel just terrific compassion in the man for people and their failings and their situations. You know, you're next, ma'am, and then Mandy, and then over here.
Well, I grew up in a small town in North Dakota, and my brothers too. And I live in a small town in Washington, and my husband died in a car accident. We both did about 9 years ago. And when I came home from the hospital, one of my neighbors had come in and cleaned the whole house. The neighbors had brought food, and there were all kinds of things like that going on.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, who,
my one brother who now lives in Southern California said that would never happen where he did. He was just astounded.
Yeah, even in my hometown, I feel like actually funerals are the times of the most intense community there. Go ahead, Mindy.
The one thing I see a lot in the story, especially just coming out of college, where a lot of people from the college are from small towns. They go to Augustana, seem to come out of small towns in Iowa and that sort of thing. I see a lot of Larry and Foxy and all the other people being the kids that grew up and it was too much for them. It was too close. I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. The kind of what was the word that they used for the Catholics that leave, and they said that they were rebelling against orthodoxy. Like, I'm gonna get out of this small town. But it seems like when they come home, they're completely lost any connectedness with the town, except for Corinne, who seems like she can.
Right.
She's the one that can cross over and come back.
Isn't that nice? I mean, yeah. The other three seem to have it, like the people that that Father Engel preaches about. They seem to have embraced dullness of spirit, haven't they? I mean, they've ceased to be fully human in some important way.
And the town won't connect with them either anymore. They're just completely separated.
And partly because of their compulsive rejection of the town. You know? Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes?
I think that most of us, wherever we grew up and wherever we live now, are within three or at most four generations from the farm.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think the Norwegian Lutherans are completely different from the German Methodists.
Right, right. I'm sure that's
so. I think we can all find things that we resonate with in our inheritance, even if they aren't things we've personally experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Speaking of his compassion, it goes to animals too. I remember one incident where he was talking about how he and his cousin are out there at his uncle's farm. And there's two pigs in the pen that are going to be butchered the next day for meat. And he was throwing stones at him, he and his cousin. His uncle chewed him out. He said, "Don't you abuse those pigs, you know." He said, "Well, they're going to be killed tomorrow. What's the big deal?" He says, "Those pigs are going to sacrifice their life for our meat.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you abuse them.
Yeah.
Respect them."
Yeah.
I've helped butcher before, too.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle.
There is a sweetness about that. He's got a hilarious butchering story about butchering chickens. Have any of you read it by any chance? It was in one of the books. Oh, God, it's funny. It's actually a kind of satire resurrection story. One of the chickens has its head chopped off, and he contrives to have its wound cauterized by the blow of the axe, so it actually runs blocks around the town with its head cut off. Oh, God, it's funny. It is so funny. You're going to say something.
Well, yeah, I kind of got caught up in what you were saying,
yeah,
so I forgot what I was going to say. I was thinking about how he's just non-judgmental. And, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I was thinking about comparing him with Annie Lamott, because she makes a point of saying grace comes in glimpses, and, you know, the rest of life is just life.
Yeah.
And I think he does that, too.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
Because Corinne's life, I mean, I find, you know, what happens in her home kind of depressing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, with her having all those papers to grade over the holidays. And with these...
freezer.
I mean, you know...
And she's alone.
Yeah, she's alone, yeah.
And she'll never have kids.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what she says in the mask. So that, I mean, you know, the grace that we see in his stories are just... flash is just the glimpses too, and
one of the best Christmas stories I've heard of his was these two brothers that had an argument a long, long, long time ago and never settled it, and at Christmas time was the one time both of them thought each year they were going to settle it, and they got that close every time, and then came up with 100 reasons why they were never going to forgive each other. And just a powerful story.
Yeah, he's so good with that. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why there has to be the Catholics and the Lutherans in Lake Wobegon. There have to be these differences that divide people. You know, the Fords. How does it go? Is it the Catholics who buy Fords and the Lutherans who buy Chevys in Lake Wobegon?
Bunsen Motors and what's the other one?
Something like Bunsen Motors and Krebsbach Chevy,
yeah.
I think
Charles
it is. Krebsbach. Yeah. I'm wondering why you think, you must have noticed because I kind of alerted you to this, that there's more than one reference to this business of two roads. There's, of course, the poem, which is, you know, mentioned a couple times, but then also in that little weird vignette at the beginning about the murderers that young Garrison thinks about as he lies in bed. What do you make of that? What's Keeler doing with this issue of two roads? I mean, obviously it represents choice, as I wrote earlier, and apparently have gotten rid of. Yeah.
I might be way off here, but like for me, it seems like there are always two kinds of Christmases, like the real Christmas and then the commercial Christmas. Mm. And I kind of felt that in like the raw, just like painful humanity of these characters, and the Christian tension to kind of wrap it all up nice and like, you know, go to church the right way and whatever. But yeah, maybe not a major theme, but that's what came up for me.
No, it is. I mean, I think, you know, the characters in the story make choices, and it's interesting to sort of be alert to the kinds of choices they need to make. And I think that's an interesting one. Yes?
I think a good symbol of the distinction between those two is the microwave that had sat under the bed for a whole year
yeah.
and couldn't use it.
Right.
So that's the commercial Christmas.
Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to do at Christmas is give things like that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's so clever in, you know, listing the buttons on the thing. Overstop, clear, from, time, recall, auto, memory.
Yeah.
Which is all what's happening to these characters as they return home. They're on auto, they're transfixed by memories, time is an issue,
who would
recall.
Think of that stuff,
I know, isn't that clever? I mean, he's so good with that stuff.
Yeah.
He's so good with that stuff.
I think when you have two roads, you never know if you've taken the right road, and you can never
that's
know what would have happened if you'd taken the other road.
Ding, 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 ding.
Can you see it again?
She got it right, Martin? Pardon? Well, somebody needs to review what you just said.
I didn't hear the beginning.
Yeah, Jen didn't.
You said that you take the road less traveled, but you never know what the other road would have led you to, and you never can know. So
that's right.
You know, life is always a continuous. You marry a certain person, and this woman married someone that put her down all the time.
Right, and who knows how that's going to turn out, and what to do about it, right? And Corinne has discovered herself in middle age alone. But, you know, isn't it lovely? It appears that she is, in a sense, a kind of parent to 132 kids writing about poems.
Yeah.
She cares about whether they're developing into people who can sort of decenter into adult life instead of being fixated upon themselves, like Foxy, Hetty, and Larry. Isn't that the point there, I think? Now, what you just said really interests me because, in fact, if you read Frost's poem carefully and properly, it says exactly what you just said. It's not, as every commencement speech ever given on that poem says, that we must choose the right path instead of the wrong path, and that will make all the difference for us. Nonsense. The poem says, I went to a wood, there were two paths. Both were equally trodden. I had no basis for choice. So I went down one thinking I might come back to the other one, but I never did. And someday I will be telling people that I went down that road and it has made all the difference. But he doesn't say he chose the right road. He says, I will be telling people that I chose the right road.
The clue is in the title of the poem, it's The Road Not Taken.
Right.
It's not.
Because that one, we don't know where it would have taken.
That's the road that's...
That's the one that matters. Well, they both matter. But really, that poem is about the anxiety of making choices, not about the whole false issue of making correct choices. You're next.
Back to your little vignette about the murder in the beginning, what struck me was the kid's sense of responsibility and this compulsion. He had to get in the bed the certain way he wanted, but the fact that the whole family security was on
his shoulders.
Right.
Well, and it raises another interesting issue about religion, how there is such a thing as something like superstitious religion, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Like a compulsion to keep fear at bay, rather than a genuine entering into what the Gospels have to tell us about how we can engage with each other and engage with Christ. That compulsive staving off of fear is no way to live. He seems to say. You're next.
Well, about the choice thing, you know, I think one of the things that I find so mature about Keeler's approach to life is just that it almost doesn't, I don't want to say it doesn't matter which choice you make, but there's grace no matter where you go.
That's right.
You never have to wish that you'd gone the other way. It's not
that. That's right. That's right. Corinne made choices, and she's ended up with a vocation, hasn't she? She's got a meaningful vocation. You know.
I don't know that the woman that was the beauty queen would have thought the way you thought, Mark.
Well, I don't think he gives up on her either, though. I mean, she has hope. I mean, she's still got a life ahead of her. I mean,
yeah, I guess I didn't feel that, but I can see.
I guess the one thing I would say about her is that she seems to react with grace and integrity even under the assault of her.
Yeah, she looks at him.
I don't consider that integrity.
Just sad.
No?
Just set yourself aside and take the abuse. I really don't consider that integrity.
No, I can understand that argument too. I can understand that. Right.
I have to agree because I've known several women in that situation, and when they finally drew the line and left, there was such a difference in their personality, and they finally were able to bloom.
Right, right. And that may very well be what needs to happen in this case, right? Yeah. Certainly, certainly.
Was there any mention in this of grandchildren at all?
There was a mention of not having grandchildren.
Only that Corinne wouldn't provide it.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the stories about the exiles, it's been kind of funny. This is Thanksgiving time. This was one of the tapes he was selling several years ago. About the family coming home, from the big city, and as they're approaching town, the father says, now children, when we get to dinner, your grandfather's going to bow his head, and he's going to say a prayer, and he's going to talk to God. And this little voice in the back seat pipes up and says, Daddy, who's God? He says, oh my gosh, we're two blocks from home, I got to expect this kid to look through theology. Something like that.
Yeah.
That always struck me as being funny.
He's a hilarious writer. I love reading his stuff. I love listening to the show, which I almost never get to. Well, let me close with another little tidbit from Garrison Keeler. In his book, We Are Still Married, which came out in 1989, he lists a series of books that are coming soon after he also listed the books that he's published already. And, of course, they're satirical. The first one, this is 89, of course. The first one is, What Will Our World Be Like in the Year 1990? That's the next book coming. But the second to last one is my favorite one. The Christian faith, is it helping us or holding us back? I leave you with that question as we end today. The Christian faith, is it helping us or holding us back? So thanks for being here.